Ah, the halcyon days of the Hawke Keating government. As many have said, it's as good as a government gets. Its achievements were many, providing economic prosperity through competition policy, market deregulation, strategic privatisation, and improvements in the social safety net. But not even the most successful governments can achieve all they set out to do. So how on earth did this team of ambitious, outspoken, highly strung personalities with the untold clashes of egos and agendas manage to make it work? Gareth Evans, Professor Gareth Evans, joins me to discuss matters arising. These days, Chancellor of the ANU in Canberra. Within the Hawke Keating government, he served as AG, as Minister for Resources and Energy, Minister for Transport and Communications, and at the same time, as Foreign Minister for 8 years. And he's now done a Richmond Crossman type diary, or he wrote it years ago, but he's now published it. It's called Inside the Hawke Keating Government, a cabinet diary, and it joins the plethora of it's the sudden rush, the new genre of political writing. Gareth, I remember not so long ago where there was hardly any, when there was the great long drought of political commentary by the players.
Still not very many diaries. You've got an awful lot of memoirs, some rather self-serving ones. You've got an awful lot of commentaries and analyses and histories, but it's still a pretty unusual thing to sit down night after night after night and actually record stuff as it's happening, because the trouble about publishing this, of course, is you don't get to varnish it and smooth it and rewrite it and demonstrate that you're really much smarter than you actually were at the time.
I have a feeling that Mark Latham did a bit of that.
Mark Latham?
Polishing his diary. We get stuck into the diary, it's a tumultuous day in Australian politics, and I have to ask you, following our previous story on matters Middle Eastern, if you were our foreign minister at this very moment, how would you be playing it?
Pretty much as Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten both are, drawing a distinction between humanitarian motivated focused military support and generalised support for conduct of a war to re-establish the integrity of the Iraqi state. I think if you're going down the latter path, there lie beasties all over the place, and the possibility of getting back into 2003 territory. If we confine our intervention to a response to mass atrocity crimes, genocide, major crimes against humanity that are manifestly occurring and many, many thousands of people at risk still in northern Iraq, then I think we are operating totally defensively in terms of moral and political principle. No legal issues involved, because we're in there with the support of the Iraqi government. And this is doing absolutely the right thing, and it's totally consistent with this doctrine of the responsibility to protect, which I've been a bit involved in over the last decade, in which the international community has agreed that not only do states have a responsibility to protect their own people from atrocity crimes, but others have a responsibility to assist them to do so. And I think that's what we're doing at the moment.
So what you've just said is my hypothetical foreign minister wouldn't be a jot different if you were still the CEO of the International Crisis Group.
No, but it wouldn't have been a jot different if I'd been foreign minister. Now, I mean, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who, deeply conscious of the need to weave a course through these things, deeply conscious of the possibility of mission creep, deeply conscious of the possibility of things going fundamentally wrong and biting off more than you can chew and trying to do good but doing a lot more bad in the process. All of this is, of course, so far as Iraq itself is concerned. If we were to go into Syria, then the situation changes a bit, because it would, at the moment anyway, be manifestly without the support of the Syrian government. There probably wouldn't be an awful lot of chance of getting Security Council unanimity about that, and the risks are probably higher. But you can't necessarily do everything, but you can do this stuff a bite at a time, and I think the bite that's been taken at the moment is absolutely the right one, totally defensible.
Okay, a detour to Ukraine. What about that?
Well, we've just heard the news of a ceasefire. God knows how that has been crafted and what is going to continue on the ground. Is it going to be a frozen conflict with very substantial Russian influence still maintained, or Russian dominance maintained, as has been the case in the southern Caucasus with Georgia, South Ossetia, Abkhazia and so on? Or is it going to be a genuine pullback of that Russian intrusion, a genuine restoration of the integrity of the Ukrainian state? Anyway, whatever it is, I mean, it's highly desirable, of course, that the fighting has stopped. But I think everyone wants to know what the circumstances are, because it's a very, very difficult one to handle, obviously, because nobody wants to get into a full-scale war. There's deep reluctance to do that. But equally, obviously, even more so now than was the case with Crimea a few months ago, you really do have a pretty fundamental breach of the post, you know, war international order. Every rule in the book is pretty much here being torn up by Putin and his troops. And just to let this go by without demur is unconscionable. I think the only game in town probably is some really, really fierce sanctions being imposed, and in particular financial sanctions of a kind that will really cripple the capacity of big business to operate. But even that's going to take time.
I told you off air that I had breakfast yesterday with our mutual friend Paul Keating, who's not the most generous in handing out accolades to others, but he spoke very warmly about the book. And at the launch, he said of you that you had an idea of where you wanted to take the people, and you were able to explain it to Australians. Why is it so difficult for today's mob on both sides to articulate a clear message the way tended to happen during the Hawke Keating years?
Well, they have got a bit spooked by the 24/7 media cycle and the relentless pressures on them to comment on every passing tram car and have a position which wins the argument of the day or the argument of the four-hour news cycle. And I think you've just got to stand back from that somehow and recognise that you've got to have a properly crafted story to tell, as we did, and we can spend time spelling that out if you like.
Please, spell it out.
And you've got to communicate. But, I mean, in spelling it out, I mean, I think that the critical story was this, and it was the beginnings of the third way. This is not something that was invented by Tony Blair. It was Tony Blair and Gordon Brown having light bulbs go off as they saw what we were doing when they visited Australia. Basically, it had these three elements. It had very, very dry economic policy, productivity-focused, competition-focused, competitiveness-focused, and very warm, at the same time, social policy, with the square being circled by this concept of the social wage. You got the trade union movement, got working people to exercise wage restraint in the interests of budget and economic credibility against traditional dry market standards. But at the same time, you compensated for that with the superannuation package, now being torn apart unhappily as we speak, but with health policy, with education policy, all of which resulted in very real, tangible, calculatable returns. And so you got the efficiency bit right and you got the equity bit right at the same time. And then you add on top of all that the notion of liberal internationalist foreign policy, which
I remember being dragged kicking and struggling as a loyal Labor Party member with some of the policies. It certainly caused a lot of unease within the party. But yes, finally we all climbed on board. But I haven't had the same sense of clarity in the Rudd governments, in Gillard, and I don't see much sign of it, in Her Majesty's opposition with Shorten now.
Well, I think they're very conscious of the need for this. I mean, naturally, they've been a bit sucked into this cycle of negativity because of the obvious success that Abbott had with that kind of sloganeering negative strategy in opposition, and there'll always be a temptation to do that. And they've got some very good stories to tell in terms of broken promises and in terms of an assault on basic equity and so the way so many of these budgetary proposals are operating. But I've been talking a lot to colleagues in the parliamentary party just in the last few days and weeks, and I think there's a pretty deep consciousness that, sooner or later, a more coherent total story has to be put together. With not only the fairly obvious negative assault continuing to be made, but a positive story being told about where we're going to go and how we're going to get there and how we are going to address this longer-term problem of debt and deficit and generally keeping the economy competitive.
Okay, you've outlined the vision splendid that the Hawke-Keating government had and managed by and large to express. And yet, at the same time, you point out that getting there was often, quote, incredibly complex but also messy. And that's a direct reference to the process of policy making in cabinet.
Well, it's a phenomenally messy process. It always is. But it's important that it be messy and that there be a collective decision-making process rather than a top-down stamping of presidential-style authority. I think the really distinguishing characteristic of the Hawke-Keating government, when you go back and look at it, and I've given page after page after page of examples of this, is just how contestable and how contested everything was. You didn't have Hawke or Keating coming into cabinet with a thought bubble or some proposal and plonking it down on the table and everyone timorously looking around and being deferential. I mean, some of the discussions we had on these policy issues was the functional equivalent of a cage fight, with language to match. I mean, there's one case I talk about over two or three pages of a thought bubble from the ERC, the Expenditure Review Committee, chasing some last budgetary gains and wanting to make a big, ugly impact to show how tough they all were, and proposing what was in effect the equivalent of a Medibank co-payment, variations on that sort of thing. And there was just a collective intake of breath around the cabinet table, and there was a fight on. And the fight went on for 4 or 5 hours, and eventually both Hawke and Keating retired hurt, said, well, this is not going to play, we've got to do it. And that happened over and over and over and over again. I mean, there's one famous occasion when which I describe, which is, I think, unparalleled in the annals of Westminster government, where everybody got sick of Hawke being preoccupied and not starting the cabinet on time, waiting, being sent away, come back. So half a dozen of us were waiting outside the cabinet room. We said, bugger this, we're going to start the cabinet without him. So we went in there and we spent 25 minutes working our way through three quarters of the agenda. And instead of Hawke coming in storming with outrage, I mean, he was actually rather sheepish about it all. But that was the environment. It was an environment that operated on the basis of argument rather than authority. And I think it is terribly important.
And at his best, Hawke was good at chairing such a discussion, wasn't he? Whether it was
or
the tax summit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I describe a number of occasions when we were a bit frustrated with his chairmanship, because when he didn't have a clear outcome in mind and he had plenty of time, he would let things meander and wait for some sort of consensus to emerge rather than helping to craft it. But it's perfectly true that both Hawke and Keating were, in their different ways, good chairmen because they understood the need for a genuine consensus to emerge. They had respect for the quality of the cabinet members, I think justifiably so, if I'm not speaking out of turn, because we did bat quite a long way down. It was a very competent group of people around the table. And they knew that if they did try and throw their weight around and try and enforce stuff policy down our necks that we were uncomfortable with, that it was going to end in tears for the government. We had a few early examples of some, forays of captainship, perhaps the Coombe affair in the first few weeks of government, which I got my fingers very badly burnt because I was one of those that was a bit too deferential, I think, to Hawke at that stage, who'd just won an election and was determined to
I can't imagine you being too deferential, to Hawke.
Well, I
mean, you've always been a bit of a handful, young Gareth.
Well, when you read the book, you'll see that I continued to be pretty soon thereafter. But I think there were some cases, the MX missile thing, which you may remember, where some, more or less solo decisions were made, which looked like ending in tears because the cabinet as a whole was pretty unhappy with some of it. And that dynamic reasserted itself very early on, asserted itself, of genuine collectivity. There was also pretty reasonable respect for the caucus. I mean, not total respect for the caucus, and we certainly didn't allow ourselves to be bossed around by the caucus, but the caucus committee system worked very well, and there was a willingness to argue these things out.
And after the chaos of the Whitlam years, this is a pretty impressive comeback, isn't it?
Well, we're all deeply conscious that for all its wonderful charm, and I was obsessed with implementing the unimplemented Whitlam law reform agenda, which is why my early career ended in tears because nobody else was very interested in that. But we're all deeply conscious that the Whitlam government had been dysfunctional in all sorts of ways. And we didn't want to repeat that. And one of the things we did running into 83 was put together a task force on government administration, which addressed this whole interrelated series of issues about cabinet caucus relations, internal dynamics, relationship with the public service and so on, which we actually pretty well maintained for the whole 13 years in government. And I think there are some lessons there very much to be learned by the current generations.
Before becoming a minister, you worked, I'm now cherry-picking things that I found particularly interesting, you worked alongside AG Lionel Murphy in drafting a Human Rights Bill of Rights for Australia, something that a recent incumbent as foreign minister in Bob Carr always Hated. I loved it. This is one of the things that never got passed. Heartbreaking.
Well, it was a pretty quixotic enterprise in retrospect. A lot of that law reform stuff, a lot of that big bang civil liberty stuff was wonderfully attractive to the party in opposition when we were kicking around the government, but became rapidly less so when we were in government, partly because of the preoccupation with the economic agenda, partly because everybody realised what a gigantic amount of parliamentary time this stuff was going to take. Everybody realised pretty quickly how controversial it was going to be. Nobody was going to eat out of our hand. And some of the stuff I was doing, like freedom information legislation and so on, was utterly at odds with the interests of my fellow cabinet ministers in untrammelled executive authority. So when you put all that lot together, it wasn't a very comfortable period to be working through. And, you know, it was very disappointing to me because my pre-parliamentary career had been as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young libertarian lawyer with a very big agenda of these sorts of things to try and implement. And, you know, I did do some of that stuff. I worked with Susan Ryan, got the sex discrimination bill up. All the later native title stuff, of course, was very much in that tradition. I'm very proud of that.
But I think there should be all the more so because I distinctly remember Hawke as opposed to Keating once he was given the Mabo judgment to deal with, that Hawke was never terribly interested in Aboriginal issues.
Well, Paul's been a bit rude about him in that respect in the last few days, I think probably excessively so. I think Bob did understand the gravity of the injustice that was involved and did emote quite a lot visibly and genuinely about that. But when it came to doing the really hard stuff, to taking on the Brian Burkes and the West Australians and the thugs in north of the Queensland border and so on, Bob always seemed to have other more pressing priorities, and it wasn't really until, admittedly, this is very difficult stuff because we didn't have the High Court wind in our sails in those early years. It was a matter of trying to negotiate stuff that was very much a state prerogative. And it was only with the Mabo judgment, which Paul sort of inherited and then ran with in a very big way, that things moved. So I wouldn't be too rude about Hawkey in this respect. I think he was absolutely genuine, but he found it difficult to deliver.
I vividly recall sitting beside you on an aeroplane from somewhere to somewhere after you'd just been anointed as Minister for Holes and Pipes, and you're looking out the window at the landscape you'd inherited, and you weren't too happy. And yet You came to quite like that portfolio, didn't you?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I wasn't emotionally attached to it in the way that I had been to AGs and all the law and justice stuff, but I was intellectually hugely fascinated by it. And as you got into it and all the physical dimensions of it and rushing around the country and in between going to the Moomba gas field, visiting the Birkenwills dig tree, or, you know, burrowing down through enormously long, deep holes and gazing uncomprehendingly at pipes out on offshore platforms and so on. I mean, I really did get a sense of what the real economic energy of this country was all about. And you know, the problems that we're dealing with, you know, stopping the collapse of the North West Shelf Project and introducing, you know, petroleum resource rent tax legislation and so on, which had some uncomfortable recent memories because we haven't been quite as successful in later government. All of this stuff was really deeply fascinating. Hawke, of course, always said to me, and I record this a number of times in the book, you know, it was the best thing he ever did for me was to sack me from Attorney General's and put me into this portfolio where I was able to restore some credibility.
But God, that hurt at the time, though, didn't it?
Well, of course he was dead right, but I never gave him the satisfaction of acknowledging that at the time, and I still find it difficult to do that now. But of course it hurt. But Hawke had larger government objectives in mind. I was proving a bit of a liability because I was young and enthusiastic and a bit immature and a bit inclined to put my foot in the mouth.
Okay, was there any jealousy on Bob's part? He'd like to think of himself as the smartest bloke in the room. Anyone who challenged that viewed with too much affection.
No, well, we all like to think we're the smartest bloke in the room, and only Kevin has ever succeeded in demonstrating that, I think. But IQ and EQ are something different, but that's another story. No, I don't think that was a factor at all with Hawkey, any of that sort of stuff. I think it was more a matter of he saw the stuff that I was passionate about, the law reform stuff, as being a distraction from the main political game, and let's face it, it probably was. It wasn't something he was inherently, instinctively, personally very interested in at all. And then I compounded those problems for him by having, created some quite spectacular publicity for the government, not of an entirely welcome kind, on issues like the spy flights and so on, all of which I explain in the diary, but I'm sure not within...
This is when you became christened Biggles, yeah?
Well, I christened myself Biggles. This was the problem. I said, whatever you do, don't call me Biggles, and, on the Brer Rabbit sort of principle and the briar patch. But one of the things you learned very early on, unfortunately it took me some time, was that A, a sense of humour, and B, a self-deprecating sense of humour is an extreme liability in politics. If you call yourself a dill, I mean, people are just going to take you at face value and believe it. So, Gough had that problem up to a point, and I certainly had it.
Yes, Gough actually did have that problem, didn't he? Again and again. He would say something which, in person-to-person terms, was incredibly funny. But on paper, when printed, it just seemed beyond stupid or arrogant.
Yeah, well, you're all prima donnas, but I am prima donna assoluta, remember, which is very, very funny when you hear it, but then you look at it and you think, my God, this arrogant character.
An excellent example. You talk about John Kerr's legacy being to delay the emergence of an Australian Republic. How so?
Well, it was such a divisive thing to have done, and it made the left in particular, the Republican forces in Australia, deeply determined to elect the Governor-General. But those of us who were, you'll remember these arguments, fiercely fought within the Republican side, those of us who were worried about the inability to simultaneously change the rest of the Constitution so that these huge powers would remain vested in the Governor-General, the argument was that if you were directly elected, the propensity for misuse of the power would be even greater in the future than in the past. And that actually, divided what otherwise was a cause that I think had its own historical inevitability. I mean, Kerr was such a grotesque that he made people feel so intensely strong that no one like this should ever, hold office without being the subject of an election, that it was a bit counterproductive.
Are you as puzzled or as astonished as I've been by Malcolm Fraser Mark II, the Ayn Randian, who has now become beloved of the left and even seems to be on quite good terms with Gough?
Well, you're used to people sort of bypassing you on the right as they get older, but whooshing past you to the left, as Malcolm has with so many of us, is a bit disconcerting. And, I had the pleasure of being asked by him to do a blurb jacket comment for his book on the American alliance. Well, I thought he had a lot of very sensible things to say about unnecessary independence, but I'm actually chopping up the alliance was, a bit of a bridge too far. But look, the point about Malcolm, he's always been a very complex figure. And one thing I have...
Always good on Africa.
Always good on race, more particularly. Yeah, it wasn't just Africa, it was Indigenous affairs, it was part of everything. And there's a story about that, of course, which I still don't think is very widely known out there in the public domain, but I can testify because I was at his college at Oxford where all this happened. He went there as a sort of a gawky, shy, aristocratic son of the Western District, found himself without any friends at all in a rather hostile sort of English snooty environment until an Indian kid, young man, moved in on the staircase opposite, and they formed a very, very closely bonded friendship, which I think from that moment on, and this is not something I've heard actually from Malcolm, he tends to sort of bypass all this, but from his tutor, who I had when I was at Oxford many years later, and this does seem to be the story, that this personal thing made him recognise the absolute horror and indefensibility of racial prejudice, and he's been fantastic on that stuff all along. Much to the dismay of his own side of politics through all those years, back in the 60s and 70s, of course.
People, when they get a book like this, always go first to the index, as I'm sure my friend Barry Jones did. And Barry rang me.
My favourite index entry of all time, you probably talked about, is in David Marr's book on Barwick. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Hawk RJ, no mention of. Anyway, I haven't got one of those in mind.
Anyway, Barry rang, and he was, he first of all was a bit wounded about some of the things you said about him, but on balance he said, well, he thinks it was a fair cop. But he was quite shocked by the things you said about others. You were fairly tough on John Button, not that Barry was very fond of John. You were tough on Michael Duffy. You were terribly tough on Lionel Bowen, whom you describe at a meeting as being his usual conservatively incomprehensible self. Now, I know you can argue...
A mixture of muddle that prejudice, I think, was also there somewhere.
I know that it balances out a bit, that a scathing reference on one page is to some extent offset by something nice 20 pages later. But the thing that fascinates me in this new era of political biographies and published diaries is that you all attack everyone. You all attack your comrades and each other, and yet you still go to each other's book launches.
Yeah, well, I mean, the diary genre does lend itself to a bit of extravagance, I suppose, because the mood of the day when you're really pissed off at what someone has said or why you're being kicked around on some favourite cabinet submission translates itself into a degree of waspishness which probably doesn't withstand, you know, long-term objective scrutiny. But, and I did think long and hard about, you know, editing most of that stuff out, but then, you know, really to do that would be to lose the whole point. And if you start doing that, then you start correcting your judgments about all sorts of other things. The justification, I suppose, is A, that's what it was like. B, I'm absolutely sure they were saying all sorts of things about me and, you know, it's totally reciprocated. C, it does change from page to page. I mean, as you just said, I mean, you're incredibly Keating is saying it's inconceivable that you could ever work with the Joe Dawkins, and 50 pages later you've got Keating in rapturous embrace. But there's one line in there where Paul and I are talking, you know, towards the end of the period, and we're both saying ruefully to each other, well, we agreed that each of us had been screwed by Hawkey on so many occasions that the first fine, careless rapture had rather evaporated. But we were nonetheless determined to keep the marriage going. And I think that was the case. I mean, we did have a higher sense of collective enterprise and collective endeavour. And it was real. And there was, you know, for all the terrible things we said about each other, there was basically an underlying respect. I mean, everyone around that cabinet table thought pretty highly of the competence and integrity of most of the peers. So, you know, that's what I mean, that's one of the reasons I waited 30 years rather than 30 minutes like my latter-day colleague to produce the diary, because some of this stuff is wounding, but then that's what it's like.
When I was looking over your shoulder at the diary, I was wondering whether you, history was looking over your shoulder when you were writing. In other words, were you writing for publication?
Well, I was writing with the view that there might be something publishable there. But it wasn't with the assiduous dedication of a Richard Crossman or some others that have known from day one, you know, from taking office, that their role in life is going to be to record it, warts and all. I tell the story of how I started writing. It was really well into my term. I'd been there, well, you know, nearly 2 years. But it was the day I started writing, the day I lost pre-selection for the lower house seat, which had looked like a winnable thing. And that, of course, was the route to possible greater glory in the lower house, leadership and so on. Many are called, but few are chosen. But nonetheless, that ambition is part and parcel of the political process. And I lost it. And I thought, that's it. That's my one big chance of moving down and getting into that milieu. I am destined to be basically a spectator of this enterprise, whether it's just for another year or two, whether it's longer, remains to be seen. But why not make the most of that spectator's position and start writing some of it down? Because I had been entranced, as many of my generation had been, by the Crossman diaries and what that revealed.
Let's, as we wind up, let's take one particular moment in political history and talk about that. Tell us about your big scene with Bill Hayden.
My big scene? I had multiple big scenes with Bill Hayden.
The ultimate scene. I'm thinking of the time when you were among the leaders who suggested to Bill it was time to go.
Oh, right back at the beginning. No, this is, of course, before the diary starts. And I wasn't a really central player in that. John Button, you know, was the central player. And, you know, it was probably the most courageous thing John ever did in politics. You know, and it was a very, very tough call to make, but he made it in the larger interests of the party. I found that very difficult. Yes, I was there. I was one of the decision makers who was piling the pressure on. I was very close to Hawke at that stage. I was gathering up numbers and so on. But But it was a hideously difficult thing to do because all of us, you know, with all Bill's idiosyncrasies and vagaries and so on, he was an incredibly decent man with incredibly good values, incredibly steeped in the traditions of the Labour Party and had done very well in opposition. So I think all of us, you know, just felt pretty dreadful about the whole thing. I mean, but I don't record any of that in the book. So
if there's a constant stream of people into prime ministerial offices saying, get out. It's got the shelf life of yogurt now.
Yeah, well, that's not smart, I think. I mean, you know, I can't pretend that I haven't been involved in that enterprise when we're in opposition, but doing it to someone who hasn't even served out a single term of government without a very clear rationale, or at least one that you're capable of communicating to the wider community, that way lies madness, and I think we've seen a bit of that.
Gareth, a tonic to talk to you. Gareth Evans' diary is inside the Hawke Keating Government, a cabinet diary, published now by none other than, who else, but Melbourne University Press. On our next, the head of the Fukushima nuclear facility speaks out, and we will celebrate the life of Nina Simone. Stick around now for the news on RN. I will talk to you in 23 hours.